and the Son and the Holy Spirit, one God. Amen. This is the fifth Sunday of the month, and on the fifth Sunday of every month, because we consider it to be a blessing to pray five times in a month, we always pray the multiplication of the loaves and of the fish. As a matter of fact, we are going to say this, or pray this same gospel in 2 weeks from today. Because the reading for the first 6 months is always the gospel from the second Sunday of Mishir. So it will be the second Sunday of Mishir in, as I said, in two more weeks. So I'm going to talk about this in a particular way so that when in 2 more weeks you are here listening, it will not be redundant. There's something. Come on, guys. Resolve the issue. Yeah. So the first line is, then Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude coming toward him. And then the narrative begins. St. John Chrysostom speaks about this in his exposition of the gospel, saying, what was Jesus doing prior to that? So you have to remember, Jesus is God. A lot of times in incarnationally, we think about Jesus as those who were with him at the moment, a gifted rabbi, a wonder worker. Maybe John the Baptist, maybe Elijah, maybe, and people had different names from him at different times, thinking, you know, that this spirit, because of course he was contemporaneous with John the Baptist, he wouldn't have been John the Baptist in flesh, but they knew that this spirit survived and they were befuddled by it. And sometimes when we think about who he was really, we forget about God sitting on the ground. I remember seeing for the first time a picture of Pope Shenouda when he was a very young bishop. And he was sitting on the ground, on the bare ground, not on a rock, just on the ground. And he had his staff with him. It wasn't the staff of his episcopacy. It was this, just a staff like any shepherd might have. And, you know, if you've seen Pope Shenouda's cave, if you've been there, it's Pope Shenouda wasn't very tall. and his cave is not very... Well, I could not stand up in Pope Shenouda's cave. So it was the perfect place for him to be. But as this picture was taken in front of it, I believe, it was either taken by Otto Meinardis or it was a picture that someone lent him and he published it in his book. He's sitting on the ground. And you know, there's protocol. If you've been to where Pope Shenouda is, there's always a big chair in the midst of a bunch of smaller chairs in any meeting room, in any gathering place. Or there's a center chair, and you know who that one's for. If there's nobody occupying it. Of course, there was one American guy that came to Egypt in 1979, and there was a big empty room with a whole lot of chairs in it, and I sat in that comfortable chair. For a bit. Then somebody came in and their face went white. I was told in no uncertain terms that that was the patriarchal chair. And so when you see someone in this condition, you realize, like, for example, there was a time when Pope Shenouda was resting on a small wall about 2 feet high, just a small retaining wall near the garden, right outside of his residence in Amba Bishoy Monastery. And he's sitting on this wall, and two bishops have come to see him. And they're puzzling about what to do. And so then finally you find these bishops sitting down on the earth because they can't sit higher than the Pope. Do you understand? They may not sit higher than... This is for the patriarch of our church. And some of these things, for Americans, it's funny. For example, if you are going to be in respect of someone and you're meeting them for the first time, you do not rest your back against the seat of your chair. You sit straight up and you never show the bottom of your feet. You will never cross your legs, ever, in front of somebody that you respect. These are things that are completely Middle Eastern and they haven't anything to do with Western culture. But you have to know where you are, who you're sitting with, and how you should be sitting. So there we come for this line in the Gospel. Now imagine, this is not Pope Shenouda. This is not the ecumenical patriarch. This is God. And he's sitting on the earth. And he's talking to his disciples, looking at them right in the eye. And then, by spirit, or by he heard a noise, he looks up. And then he sees a multitude coming. And when we're speaking about a multitude, it's mentioning 5,000 men. And as always, women weren't counted, neither were children. So there could have been 12, 15,000 people. That's a multitude. That's a multitude coming. But he looked up. And I want to emphasize this importance because this is something that St. John Chrysostom mentioned. And we don't think about these things often enough. Humility. We seldom desire to acquire the grace of humility. There was a woman in the church, and I accused her of doing something. I accused her of doing the thing that I did because somebody told me she had done it. I didn't do it out of my imagination. I never operate on the level of suspicion. I don't do that. Unless I have evidence, I will not say anything against anyone for any reason. And even though I have evidence, many times I don't say anything. So I just simply said this. And this woman started to cry. What is this evidence of except pride? Pride, incredible pride. How could I be someone who is accused of something wrong? Do you understand? What does it say about what we just prayed in the Gospel of Matthew? When you are reviled, not just accused of something, but you are reviled for all manner of evil, and here's the big word, falsely. Rejoice, it says. Now, how often has this woman heard this? It didn't penetrate at all. If somebody accuses you of something and you didn't do it, the first thing you want is to mount a strenuous defense. But you have this outrage. Me? I was accused of this. Me? Somebody once accused me of smoking cigars. I have never smoked a cigar in my life. And if you know me, my poor mother, she was a lifetime smoker as well as my father. They were never allowed to smoke a cigarette in my house. They had to go outside. Anybody who knows me, I abhor the smell of cigarette or tobacco smoke. I can't bear it. But I was accused of smoking cigars. So when somebody just stood up and said, "You smoke cigars," I just started to laugh. It was ludicrous. What does that mean? It means you know yourself. Isn't that quite different from something that you want people to know about you? See, when you know yourself, you have integrity. You know when you are weak, and somebody accuses you of being weak. Yes, I am weak. You know how smart you are. So if somebody accuses you of having fostered the equation E equals MC squared. No, that was not me. It's not a problem, is it, for somebody that knows themselves? So the beginning of humility is really just knowing who you are. I was at the gym the other day. Now, they have this these pulleys, and you can set them at different levels. And I can push the pulley all the way to the top level. But when the pulley's at the top level and I want to lower it, I'm not tall enough to be able to pull out the pin and get the pulley to the location I want it. So I have to ask somebody, right? I have to, would you help me, you know? And of course, everybody is sympathetic. And I have a place in this gym. I'm an important character. But at the same time, I have to realize that, you know, right off the bat, as soon as it's up there and I want it to be someplace else, I've got to ask. Does that diminish me? No. I didn't choose to make myself this height. I didn't choose this body. There's nothing about this that you see, this flesh, that I am ashamed of, except that I've overfed myself. That is my responsibility alone. But do you see, how does humility start? It has to start with a real appreciation of exactly who you are as God has made you, the gifts that He has imbued, and then what you've done with those gifts. Now, maybe you feel guilty. Maybe you feel guilty because God has given you something and you've never used it. You've never used it. You know, when I go to the gym, I often say inside myself, you know, the problem is not exercise. All those people are just furiously exercising. They're all fat. They're all fat. That's not solved at the gym. That's solved after you leave the gym. And isn't it funny in this world that we live in that there is a crisis in some countries because of overeating, and there's a crisis in other countries because of starvation. Some people are getting no food. Some people are eating food for a whole village. Right? You have to be comfortable with yourself in order to say that. If you say that to somebody who thinks that they aren't fat, and then you say, "You're fat." Well, I've never been so human, you know, or whatever the response is going to be. Did they never pass a scale or a mirror? You see, fat is something you can pick on because it's visual. Line 10 people up against a wall, there's fatty. You don't have to think. Okay. But who's deceitful? Who's the thief? Who's lustful? Who's got a gambling problem? Who takes drugs? Who womanizes? You can't see those things immediately. That's what black people suffer from. And occasionally Orientals. You can see an Oriental a long ways off. You can see a black person a long ways off. You put 10 white people, one black person, that's him. 100 yards away, you can see who it is. But even close up, you may not see the deceitful. You may not see the person that is really broken inside. You may not see the person that is just a disaster waiting for a spot to occur. So, people who have this particular problem are outraged because their problem is seen by everyone. They should be happy. They should be so happy. Because when you walk in this world and people can see your problem, you will, as an ordinary individual, work extra hard to make it go away. Suppose everybody knew that I was a thief. There's Father Bishoy. You know what he does? He takes money out of the box of the church and puts it in his pocket. So in this church, everybody writes checks. Not the Father Bishoy. But if everybody knew I was a thief, and every time, you know, somebody had some money, they stuffed it really down tight down in the bottom of their pocket, guess what I'd start to feel? Guess what I'd start to feel? Ashamed. Shame is the consequence of a person who realized that a virtue is escaping them. And believe me, it is a virtue to take every gift that God has given you and to, as St. Athanasius said about St. Anthony, to polish it brightly, like a stone that is placed in a diadem or a crown. So when you think about this concept of humility, of Jesus sitting on the ground, and of course, where is his throne? He's held aloft by angels. This is his throne. It's not a wooden chair that the Lord sits in. It's not a chair made of gold. It's a chair made of creatures, living creatures. They are called, if you listen, it says the thrones. The thrones. They are a class of those who support the Lord in his, well, we don't want to make it anthropocentric, so we're not going to use a term like in his rest or in his recliner, because the Lord has need for neither of those or any such thing. But this is his chair. So in the next of the narrative, the first person is mentioned is Philip. Poor Philip. Philip had some problems. And the reason that the Lord pulled Philip out of all of the rest to single him for this interrogative was because the Lord knew that Philip had some problems. Remember, later on, Philip is going to say to the Lord, show us the Lord and it will be sufficient for us. And he said, Philip, have I been so long time with you and you still do not know me? Have I been so long with you and you still do not know me? Well, you know, how could they? Once I remember when I was first getting catechized, the priest said to me, when I said, I would never do such a thing. And he looked at me and said, you would be the first to do it. Remembering that, I almost took the name Philip. There's a reason why I'm named what I'm named, and that is a long story, but I'll share it with you some, you know, other point. Philip answered the Lord as though he were an accountant. Isn't that funny? Like, suppose people show up at your house unexpectedly. I mean, it's Super Bowl, right? So some people could just like show up. Usually cultured people don't show up without an invitation, but I know everybody knows some uncultured people. So people show up at your house, right? And you've got food, you know, you've plotted it out. Like first quarter, I'm going to eat this. Second quarter, I'm going to eat this. Halftime, I'm going to take a drink. But third and fourth, I'm going to start chowing down really hard. So, that's my grandson. So, some people come over, and now what do you do? Well, you can say, well, I won't eat quite as much. But you know that's not true. You have planned for this day. It comes around once a year. You're going to eat. So, what you do, could you be more obvious?
Yes.
Now, I'm sorry for this interruption, but family members are the thing that are the most grievous to be born in the priesthood. The response of somebody who comes to your door is like, oh, we don't have enough. We don't have enough. But Philip says, Well, 200 denarii are not sufficient. I don't know if he knew what the purse held, but 200 denarii are not sufficient that we go and buy just a little bit for each one so that they can have a taste. What are we going to... 200 denarii. Where are we going to get all this money? The first thing that he thought about was that. Why did he put it in terms of economy? Right? Because that's usually what people do when they're going to have a party. You plan a budget and you think about what you can have and you spend up to that budget and you're all ready and then something extra occurs and you go, where am I going to get the money? Where am I going to get the money? Well, they didn't have ATMs and credit cards in those days, and so, you know, there was a sense that impoverishment was the main goal to solve. And here's the Lord, the creator of all. And he's saying these things on purpose. So another disciple said, we have a small boy here who had brought a lunch, but it's only sufficient for a small boy. And the Lord said, let's have a look at it. I will talk to you about the meaning of the five and the two later, in 2 weeks. But the substance is that the Lord took these things and he blessed them. Now, he didn't bless them so that, you know, when you took a tiny morsel, it satisfied you. Because that could happen. You know, it's kind of like food that's been dehydrated. You know, you put just a little bit in your mouth and then it explodes when the moisture hits it. No, it wasn't like that. And this is why that after everyone had eaten, he said, take up all the fragments that remain, that there would be a result that everyone could see. 12 baskets filled. When before the single basket contained but 5 loaves and 2 fish, now there were 12 baskets that were filled. So it was not a type of miracle that somebody could gainsay later it was kind of a mass hypnotic state that made people satisfied with this very, very little, whereas before it would have been impossible for that to have occurred. No. There is a substantial amount that was done simply because of the blessing of the Lord, the creator of everything out of nothing. So I'm not going to belabor this much longer. When the Lord is giving instruction, the instruction takes several forms. First of all, the Lord always wants us to grow. And sometime you might get a lesson from the Lord, and you know it has come from no one else. If you haven't had that experience, it may be because you didn't know how to properly attribute the experience. Because I think everybody has had that experience where you know something has been taught you in a vacuum. It wasn't anybody else that said anything to you. It wasn't the circumstances of your life that made it, you know, just uniquely yours. It was rather something that was wholly unaccountable for in any other way, where you just said, this is from God. I've experienced this many times in my life, just being alone reading the Bible. And all of a sudden, something that is a very familiar passage to me in the text will all of a sudden just be amplified, and it will resonate. You know how you hear a great piece of music sometimes? There's kinds of things. I love the romantic period of the Russians. I love Tchaikovsky and Mussorgsky, you know, and Rimsky-Korsakov and people, those kind of composers. It's a very rousing music. It's also almost like martial music, you know, meaning a band music. You know, it's and sometimes as I'm listening to something that I've heard over and over, I'll still get chills. This is what I'm trying to explain to you, where you're being talked to now, but it's not just happening up here between your ears. It's not mere intellection. It's in the entire grasp of the person in this single concept that the Lord wishes to be taught. And all of a sudden, boom, you get this thing and you go, it's almost, as they say, breathtaking. It's almost breathtaking. You just, you're struck by it. And so Philip, with these interrogatives, these questions asked him of the Lord, what are we going to do? What's the solution? And I know what Philip's thinking. Why me? Why don't you ask, Andrew or Peter or John or, why don't you ask one of them? Well, but the question is being asked of you, Philip. How are you going to respond? Remember, I told you this trick. If the Lord ever gives you three questions to ask him, the first question that you ask is, Lord, what are the other two questions I should be asking you? That's how you use up your first question. What are the other two questions I should be asking you? Because when I remember one time sitting with Amba Serapian here in the church, and across from us, Jaden was sitting. Jaden Boutros. And Amba Serapian said to him, what do you think? It was about a topic that we were speaking about. He said, what do you think? And he said, I don't know anything. I don't know anything. Well, of course he did. And of course he had an opinion. And if you know Jaden, you know he's a very bright little boy. And he's not afraid to speak. But that was the exact answer to have given. And Amba Serapian looks at me. And of course, I knew how pleased he was. Because Amba Serapian never smiles when he looks at me. But he smiled. And this was a great thing. This is the perfect thing. Imagine Philip, how he could have answered. Well, we don't have that much money. And if we took all the money that we got and we went out and we bought something, and it's a long ways away. But if we did all of that and we came back and we had the bread, and then we gave everybody, what's that? And you see? You see what he needed to be taught in this moment? Who is it that is sitting before you? Have you forgotten who I am because I'm on the ground? Because I am sitting on the ground and because I am not enthroned by the angels, have you forgotten who I am? What is my name? What is my name? Your name is, you're the one who saves his people. That's your name. You're the anointed one. Jesus the Christ, you're the anointed. That's my name. Then what do you think I'm going to do? What do you think I'm going to do? I didn't plan when I came in here today to talk about the psychology of Philip or the necessity of humility or the precursors of for being humble, which is integrity. You must know yourself. And when somebody nails you, the nail shouldn't hurt because you should have made a hole for that nail yourself. You should have pinned yourself to the wall and said, yes, I am a cheat. I am a liar. I am this, I am that, and I am more than you can see. Forgive me, I am a sinner. When I bow towards you, as I'm going to in the next few minutes, I'm going to ask you to forgive me. It's not for nothing. It's not ceremonial. It's real. I am a sinner. I am a sinner. I see, unlike all of you, well, except for Jerry. Who else? Anybody else here? Except for Jerry. We were the only ones baptized as adults. And I remember after I was baptized, I was thinking, this is the Western mind speaking, I want to make sure you understand that. How long is it going to be before I sin? Now, I don't know if the first sin that I caught was actually my first sin. There could have been a sin before that sin, but I didn't understand it was a sin. But the first sin that I caught myself making was 7 hours after I was baptized. Now, you have to understand that I was baptized before the liturgy. So that took like 4 hours. So 3 hours after having communion, I sinned. Now, if you start off with a record like that, where do you think I am now? Okay. So I'm not putting myself above anyone, but I am telling you all that if you wish to be strong, you identify the things that are in you that shouldn't be in you, and you work and you pray that everyone around you will support you in getting better. And you continue to work and you continue to pray until your last breath, so that you find acceptance. If not in success, you find acceptance from the Lord because of your effort for reconciliation, repentance, and return. Glory be to his holy name, both now and ever, and to the age of all ages. Amen.